Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 26, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's so good to have you with us here today as Christmas becomes New Year's and 2017 is largely behind us. You know, 2017 has been the year of the Me Too movement. It's been the consequential first year of the Donald Trump presidency. And also, 2017 has been the year of the catastrophic natural disaster. Today, we dedicate the full hour to looking at a year of disaster and recovery in the United States.
The word unprecedented doesn't do justice to the last 3 months of what the agency's been through.
That's Brock Long you're hearing there, the administrator of FEMA. That's the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Long's agency has dealt with wildfires out west, with Hurricane Harvey in Houston, and with Hurricanes Irma and Maria that devastated parts of Florida and the Caribbean, including Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Each one of these events, of the four events that I'm talking about, could have truly been considered catastrophic in their own right, much less them occurring in rapid succession.
But that's not all.
Before Harvey hit, the agency was actually responding to nearly 30 other disasters across a multitude of states.
So we begin this hour on disaster and recovery with a look at FEMA and the job it's done in responding. There's a lot of confusion when it comes to FEMA's mission and how the public sees its role after a natural disaster. FEMA's been shuffled around and repurposed several times over the course of its history. Historian Garrett Graff explained back in September in an interview with WNYC's On the Media.
FEMA was a very high-functioning agency up until the early 2000s.
This is after 9/11 when FEMA was shuffled again into the Department of Homeland Security and lost its direct access to the Oval Office.
And then, of course, we all remember during Hurricane Katrina.
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Well, today, FEMA Administrator Brock Long says the agency has learned from those failures. I also asked him about some of the specific criticisms FEMA has faced in Puerto Rico. Long says, overall, a lot has changed since the days of Katrina.
I think a lot of the successes that the post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act, you know, put forward is in regards to communication. So the PGMR Act that was produced as a result of Katrina allows me a direct line to the President of the United States, and direct lines of communication is incredibly vital. I also think it's really important to point out that each one of these disasters, there's not a one-size-fits-all solution for Harvey, Irma, or Maria and the California wildfires. They're each different, and they impact communities differently. And so, for example, where if you take housing, which is one of the major focuses that we have right now across all of the disasters, you know, most of the structures in California that were impacted burned to the ground. So you can't do direct construction, and you're looking at more of bringing in manufactured housing. In Harvey, something that we did that was truly innovative was we were able to put forward and implement a program where the state of Texas, we're now going to be granting money through the state of Texas down to Council of Governors to be able to do direct construction to fix some of the homes that were truly uninsured and offer up a multitude of different housing, potential housing solutions to those who are impacted, which has never been done before.
Well, let's talk about Puerto Rico and the aftermath of Maria, because there's concern about a one-size-fits-all strategy there when it comes to FEMA. After the, well, the debacle of the Whitefish Energy contract, which I know FEMA didn't offer, but were somehow involved in that $300 million energy grid contract that got canceled, there is concern, as you know, Mr. Long, that FEMA is still relying on big, giant contracts, even offering up one for $100 million to one big contractor to do lots and lots of rebuilding, instead of relying on local companies, local communities, lots and lots of smaller contracts that can get into the community for rebuilding. And there are a lot of people who I know you know, who know how FEMA operates, who say that this is a problem.
So let's talk about what an ideal response and recovery looks like. It's one that's federally supported, state managed, and locally executed. So let's put Puerto Rico in a box because it's totally unique. Everything about Puerto Rico is hard and not traditional, okay? But if you look to Texas, where the model of federally supported, state managed, and locally executed played out, the response for the whole community standpoint went very well. The recovery is involving the entire community, from not just FEMA, but also all the way down to local council of governments. Everybody has a clear role and function, and we're pushing forward with a unified plan to fix the infrastructure, but also address the housing needs. When it comes to our contracts, a lot of times, if you look at Texas, they're very self-sufficient. Florida is very self-sufficient. They execute their own contracts to do things such as debris removal, and provide other services to their constituents. And FEMA's role is to backfill the capacity of their efforts or the lack of capacity that they may experience as a result of these contracts. In Puerto Rico, because of the liquidity issues and the fact that there were no pre-event contracts established by the Commonwealth, you know, as it relates to disaster recovery, puts a lot of the 100% of the response and recovery initially on FEMA's shoulders. So we have to have a multitude of contracts. We have hundreds of contracts. And so we don't just have one blue tarp vendor. We have multiple vendors. And so the private sector is incredibly necessary for us to be able to aid state and local partners in these situations.
So you're saying that Puerto Rico in general doesn't have enough local, medium, small businesses. It doesn't have the capacity to absorb all of the money and all of the contracts that would be required for rebuilding. You mentioned blue tarps. I had read that one $30 million contract from FEMA for blue tarps had to be canceled because the company failed to deliver those. And I wonder if given the limitations, and you're the expert, I don't deny that, given the limitations, if there's no opportunity to break up big $100 million contracts like one that's on offer into somewhat smaller chunks to make more of that rebuilding money more available to companies in Puerto Rico that just might make the rebuilding more effective.
Yeah, so when it comes to contracting, again, we're very careful on the request for proposals and the request for information that we put out. In the case that you're bringing up, we have multiple vendors that have been providing blue tarps. And one thing that I think Americans have to realize is that we're not just trying to collect blue tarps for the Hurricane Maria issues in Puerto Rico. It's also the Virgin Islands. It's also Hurricane Irma. There is a drain across the country on resources. And in some cases, we have to expand the contracts through emergency bid processes to see, you know, where we might be able to find additional resources. So we're constantly expanding, you know, contract capability. And in some cases, when you're executing hundreds and hundreds of contracts, some work out well and some don't.
The recovery in Puerto Rico after Maria brought along, just give Americans your best assessment of how effective and how fast. And FEMA's there and others are there too, and this is not all FEMA's responsibility. I get that, and I'm not suggesting that it is. But Americans are watching reports even now, just the amount of electricity available creeping up incredibly slowly. And we've had many people on this air from small towns in Puerto Rico who say the recovery efforts just didn't reach them. And I was hoping, since you're the expert, you could give a really honest assessment of the speed of the recovery there and whether Puerto Rican people were served well in the aftermath of the storm.
Yep. Very candidly, I would say that, you know, the coordination of the Federal Emergency Management Agency to put the resources and firepower of the federal government down to Puerto Rico kept Puerto Rico from total collapse. And, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, security and safety was maintained, and there was a ton of food and water on the islands, and it became a messaging issue more so than it was a lack of resources being on the island. The response phase, quite honestly, considering the complexities that you lost every port of entry that was in there, was incredibly complex. When it comes to the recovery as well, I think what America needs to realize is that there's some inherent problems. One, the average age of Puerto Rico's power infrastructure is 44 years old. FEMA is not responsible for allowing that to happen. I also think it's important to say that, you know, we also are running into massive deferred maintenance issues with the power plants in general. We can't just flip a switch and get the lights on. And right now, the Army Corps of Engineers is the lead agency that is in charge of the power grid rebuild. If you look at all of the disasters, from basically the California wildfires to the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico is the only area where we've basically had to put the Army Corps of Engineers in charge of rebuilding the power grid because of the complexities of the issue. Everybody else does it basically through private contracts.
Well, Brock Long, I want to leave looking into the future. A huge part of your job, of course, is lessons learned. Every disaster has lessons learned. What is the biggest lesson learned from the last 2 months for you as administrator?
We need a true culture of preparedness in this country. I've been quoted multiple times saying that, but disaster response and recovery is everybody's responsibility, not just FEMA's. And so we have to educate that many times citizens are the true first responders for any type of event, whether it's, you know, the hurricane that they face or an active shooter event. Many times they will find themselves in a situation where they have to help their neighbors and be ready to also help themselves. As far as the agency goes, we got a lot of work in this nation to reduce the complexity of recovery. We have to do more pre-disaster mitigation and offer up more grant funding up front, which is something that we hope to work with the emergency management community and governors with. I ultimately believe that disaster resiliency lies in the hands of local elected officials. I believe they're the ones that are responsible for passing, you know, land use planning and building codes that will truly make a difference in disaster resilience in the future. And then finally, you know, the biggest lesson learned is survivable communications. As people become more and more dependent on, you know, their digital capabilities, their cell phones, we have to work very closely with the private industry to make sure that when they're implementing these systems, as we become more dependent on them, that they're redundant and that they're resilient and that they're able to withstand different disasters. Because when you lose the ability to communicate, then you lose situational awareness, and it creates a lot of panic in some cases as well, when people can't contact their loved ones for multiple days, if not weeks in some cases. So there are a tremendous amount of lessons learned, and there's always room for improvement. But again, I think the most important message is it requires the whole community.
Are you concerned that the types of disasters that you have to worry about, floods, hurricanes, and wildfires, are going to become more intense and more common?
Well, I mean, you know, is the climate changing? You know, I believe the climate's changing when it comes to that. And yes, we may see an increase, you know, activity, you know, when it comes to, you know, newer or more intense disaster events. But then I also believe that, you know, social vulnerability is also increasing as well. And it goes back to the true cultural preparedness. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I'm very passionate about is that we have to get a majority of Americans to remember that saving money, 3 to 6 months of operational funds in a savings account and creating your own individual disaster account is incredibly important. And many people can't do that right now. And so we have to be able to go back and hit the reset button on the preparedness. But, you know, our environment at FEMA is constantly changing as the nature of threats change, whether they're man-made or natural. So, you know, it's never a dull day at the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Brock Long, Administrator of FEMA. Mr. Long, thank you.
Thank you.
FEMA's at work all over the country and also in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where they're embroiled in some controversy now over how to dispose of 400,000 cubic yards of storm debris, mountains of it. The feds want to burn a lot of that debris, and that's touched off a fierce debate in the island's government and among residents. Judith Enck is the former EPA regional administrator for EPA's Region 2 that covers New York and New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands.
The good news is that the majority of what needs to be dealt with in the debris category are things that can easily be chipped and composted. And so there was a tremendous amount of momentum around composting a lot of the wood and green debris because soil was also damaged during the hurricanes. A lot of topsoil was damaged because of flooding. And even before the hurricanes, we did not have a very rich, healthy soil on the islands. And so with composting, what you get in the end is a really nice, healthy, organic soil amendment that will improve soil health. And so the plan when I was in the Virgin Islands was to work with the Army Corps of Engineers, chip a lot of this wood, and then compost it. And, you know, composting has happened for centuries all over the country. This is not high tech. This is not hard to do. And the important thing is that the wood be kept separate from all the other debris.
Well, if composting was the plan before, this has now become the source of a giant amount of controversy. Over the last month, the Army Corps and FEMA have said they want to incinerate a lot of this debris instead of composting it. The Senate in the Virgin Islands said they would ban that. The governor said he would veto the ban. The latest update, the Senate now says they'll override the governor's veto and forbid the Army Corps and FEMA and some locals from banning this debris. Where does this debate stand?
Well, it's still a debate, but thankfully, in my view, the legislature in the U.S. Virgin Islands recently voted to override the governor's veto of the Ban the Burn bill. And what's significant here is you have the legislature going on record saying they have very serious concerns about air pollution from these air curtain incinerators that the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA is really pushing the government of the Virgin Islands to do. And the legislature wants to see a more sustainable alternative. So their Ban the Burn bill not only applies to Hurricanes Irma and Maria debris, but also future hurricanes. So the U.S. Virgin Islands is poised to have a model, sustainable approach to dealing with hurricane debris if only we can get the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA to cooperate and go in a different direction.
Well, the Army Corps and FEMA have used air curtain incineration before. They used it in New York and New Jersey after Sandy and had to stop because the pollution was so bad. Is that right? So why try it in the Virgin Islands?
That's right. I was involved in Hurricane Sandy, and the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA insisted on burning a lot of the wood debris. They stopped much earlier than planned because of operational problems and air pollution problems. And you would think that would be a lesson for the Army Corps not to try this in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where it is really hot and humid. They stopped during Hurricane Sandy because there were high humidity days in Brooklyn, and temperatures were in the 40s. So in the Virgin Islands, it's routinely in the 80s and 90s, and that heat and humidity would essentially serve as a blanket over the air pollution that would come out of these air curtain incinerators. Additionally, in the U.S. Virgin Islands, if you go outdoors, you often smell diesel from the emergency backup generators. And if you go indoors, you often smell indoor mold. So people's respiratory systems are already working overtime. There's a high asthma rate in the Virgin Islands. The Senate president, Senator Myron Jackson, who deserves a tremendous amount of credit for getting the Ban the Burn bill through twice in the legislature, has spoken about as a child he struggled with asthma. So I think there's some real sensitivity to these health issues. But still, the federal government turns to burning first, I think because it's what they have always done, and also because they think it'll be quicker.
Well, they turn to burning first, it seems, in the U.S. Virgin Islands. But Judith, in Puerto Rico, the Army Corps is busy promoting the fact that they're committed to mulching and that they're not burning at all. And apparently, Puerto Rico has five times more debris even than the Virgin Islands.
Despite the challenges in removing more than 3 million cubic yards of debris from the island, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers remains undeterred, prepared to stay with the people of Puerto Rico until the job is complete.
Undeterred, prepared to remove all of that debris, and they're not talking about burning it in Puerto Rico.
Isn't that curious? I love that Army Corps of Engineers video that came out right in the nick of time for us as we were trying to convince lawmakers to ban the burn in the U.S. Virgin Islands. So in Puerto Rico, they have far more material. And I commend the Army Corps of Engineers for doing such a good job of collecting and chipping all of this so it's ready for composting. And it raises the question. They and the governor have said repeatedly that there's too much wood debris in the Virgin Islands that allows for good composting programs. But as you noted, Puerto Rico has 3 million cubic yards of wood and green waste. U.S. Virgin Islands has less than 700,000 cubic yards. If the Army Corps of Engineers can do it right in Puerto Rico, why can't they do the same thing in the U.S. Virgin Islands? I think that is a really important and at the same time troubling issue that the Army Corps still has not answered.
Judith Enck, former regional administrator for the EPA, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Later in the hour, a man who lost everything in a wildfire now helps Californians cope with the practicalities of putting their lives back together. And we've been asking you, have you ever lost everything in a natural disaster? What do you find yourself reaching for even after everything is gone?
This is Joe, now living in Maplewood, New Jersey. Our home in Cranford flooded during Hurricane Irene back in 2011. As I was trimming our Christmas tree last week, I found myself still looking for ornaments we lost in that flood. Pieces of family history that I only really think about once a year, but that I still found myself looking for.
My name is Mary Mallory. I live in suburban Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The house was almost destroyed, and pretty much everything we had was up in flames. What I missed the most, and I still, 40 years later, reach for, folks, more importantly, photographs. Thank you very much.
Your voices on putting lives back together after a natural disaster. Coming up, we'll head to Houston to take a look at some Texans who found it easier to move away than stay home and rebuild. That's coming up here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's been 4 months since Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, devastating not just the greater metropolitan area, but also the heavily populated towns and communities along the Gulf Coast. We've been spending the show today looking at natural disasters and recovery in America. And as Houston gets back on its feet, some of the Gulf's most vulnerable residents are making the hard choice to leave their homes and start new lives in new cities. Courtney Collins is the lead reporter for KERA's One Crisis Away project in Dallas. She's been following some of these families as they resettle in North Texas. And last month, Courtney took a trip to the Gulf Coast to see what they left behind.
There are so many debris piles still, and we're talking mostly moldy furniture and couch cushions, rolls of carpet that have been ripped out of someone's house and put on the curb, even clothes and shoes just kind of piled up in these little hills everywhere you look in some of these neighborhoods. A lot of houses are still tarped and caution taped, and we spoke to a couple hotel owners and managers, and they said they absolutely still have a couple handfuls of people that are using the hotel as their residence as late as mid-November.
What about everyday life? Kids back at school, people back at work, things like that?
If you didn't lose your job to the storm, meaning if you didn't have the business that you worked in destroyed and that business hasn't been able to rebuild, most people are going about their life, especially in Beaumont. I know for a fact one of my colleagues with the Texas Tribune just got back a few days ago from a trip to Port Aransas, and he said it really does not look that different than it did right after the storm hit, which really shocked him. He says there's no power lines down, no trees in the street, but they don't even have a CVS online in Port Aransas right now, which means people have to drive 45 to 60 minutes to fill prescriptions. There are so many people there living in hotels who can't go back to work because their job was taken from them by the storm. And a lot of people's FEMA vouchers are glitching, or they're not sure when they're supposed to run out, and they're running out now, or maybe they're going to run out in January, and they don't really have a plan in place.
Courtney, you're painting a picture of life for a lot of people, and maybe it's not the majority of people, but a lot of people in Beaumont and other communities whose lives haven't fully recovered after the storm. Who are some of the people that you've been talking to directly?
Well, we decided it would be an interesting reporting project if we focused on some families that had either been rescued from the storm and brought to North Texas, or who fled to North Texas ahead of the storm. So we've been profiling a couple families, a couple individuals who've decided to start over here. And one of the first women we talked to was Brandy Foster. She's a single mom with two kids. She was in Port Arthur when the storm hit and had to be rescued out.
The water did rise and came in and it wouldn't stop. We couldn't even leave by car or nothing. We had to be actually rescued out.
So she's decided to stay in Fort Worth with her two kids. She's already gotten herself a job. She's had some assistance getting housing. Some nonprofits have stepped in to help pay the bills and put furniture in her place. And she says she's really optimistic about her future in a larger city like Fort Worth.
If I wanted my kids to grow up, get scholarships, go to college, I wanted them to do it this way. I don't want them to actually struggle, go to work every day, live paycheck to paycheck. And I felt like this was the opportunity for me to show them something different.
Is Brandy's experience typical of people from Port Arthur?
So yes, we've talked to many families who are kind of in that same position. They maybe weren't super happy with their economic situation back in Beaumont or Port Arthur, and they didn't feel like they were incredibly supported or that they would be incredibly supported after the storm. So they decided, hey, why not start over somewhere a little bit bigger and hope that we can kind of turn the page on a new chapter.
The lives of people uprooted by Hurricane Harvey in Texas, many of them moving toward Dallas-Fort Worth, the home turf of Courtney Collins and the reporters at KERA. Courtney is lead reporter for the One Crisis Away Project. Courtney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
We go now to the Florida Keys. Hurricane Irma hit the Keys hard in September, but the region got a lot less coverage than other parts of the country, like Houston and Puerto Rico.
I was affected by Hurricane Irma here in the Keys, where, you know, the eye basically rolled right over my island and my immediate world, the places I go to the, you know, grocery store, local restaurants, just your day-to-day life kind of thing.
That's Justin Wood. He's a mixed media artist who lives in the Florida Keys, and part of his art revolves around a technique called projection mapping. Justin takes a projector and throws beams of light onto everyday objects, houses, debris, anything really, and digitally transforms them into works of visual art. Irma disrupted Justin's life and his community, but he's taken the opportunity to send a message from the destruction.
Upon seeing all the devastation and wreckage, I decided to try to use my video projector to transform some of that by projection mapping some of the wreckage and debris, and just turning my projector onto that and transforming it into temporary sculptures.
So, Justin, give me a sense what one of your installations looks like. I don't know, a wrecked house maybe. Before and after your projection gets to it?
Well, when you first come up on the houses, they're in varying degrees of destruction. Some are just missing a little bit. Some are entirely collapsed. So, you know, I try and pick out ones that are more dramatic looking. So, I mean, you're looking at these houses that are up on stilts, and basically the whole first and second floor are just completely collapsed. There's just, you know, shards of drywall and 2x4s and all that kind of thing sticking out. So, once I hit it with the projector, it kind of transforms the whole aesthetic of it, because I pull out all those different little planes and boards and all that stuff, and I make each one of them glow. So it kind of flattens the look of it a little bit, but it turns it from kind of this ugly just mess into sort of this glowing pile of you know, what really looks like a composed sculpture.
And what would you say your aim is here? Is it to draw the eye to the wreckage, to draw attention so that people can't ignore it?
Well, at first, I was just drawn to the wreckage, to all those different planes and the way it looked, and thought, you know, let me see what I can do with this. And then as time went on, it kind of took on a bigger meaning, because, you know, especially in the Keys here, we did not get a lot of media coverage and everything after the storm goes by, and, you know, the initial reporters are down here. It's not a major economic zone, and there wasn't huge loss of life, so things kind of move on pretty quickly. And I found it as a way to kind of keep it into public consciousness, to keep putting these images out there and having people respond to them and say, you know, this thing keeps going.
Still, you know, we've been hearing about a lot of seasonal business owners, people who have hotels, restaurants, who rely on the tourist trade, who haven't been back on their feet, who are now facing a winter in the Keys post-storm where their normal winter income is going to be drastically affected here.
Yeah, and it really affects everybody, you know, from people that work in restaurants to people that rent boats or do charters. I mean, when you have tourism diminished, it just affects everybody island-wide. And due to the destruction, a lot of the working-class housing has been eliminated and rents have gone up. So a lot of people that were living here can no longer afford to live here. There's a shortage of workers, and it's going to be, you know, so far all the indications are it's going to be a slower season coming ahead.
You know, Justin, I had read that you were in New York City years ago on 9/11. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And that you had volunteered to help clean up after the attacks in Lower Manhattan. And then I thought of the debris pile, that famous, infamous, horrible debris pile left when the towers collapsed, and how that might connect to your vision of art today.
On September 13th, I was volunteering down there and just unloading trucks and that kind of thing. But those images are burned in my memory. You know, it was at nighttime. They have these floodlights on all that stuff. And it was just the raw aftermath of just, you know, I mean, unfathomable size and scale. And, you know, just the scene with the shadows and the smoke and the, you know, firefighter standing there and them pulling out, you know, wrecked fire trucks. And just, you know, it was just burned in my memory. And I don't think until now I realized how much of an influence that had on my work. But it definitely, through this process, I realized how much of a connection it has.
Well, you can see what it looks like when Justin Wood turns his 4,500 lumen projector on an old house or a debris pile left behind by Hurricane Irma in the Florida Keys. It's all on his Tumblr page at keyslight.tumblr. Justin Wood, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
It's good to have you with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. More now on our coverage of natural disasters and recovery in America as we return to Puerto Rico, where regaining a steady supply of power and clean water remains a continuing priority. But those are the basics, and the fact that there isn't enough power and water more than 3 months after the storms is having effects in some unpredictable parts of life. Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary traveled to Puerto Rico recently to take a look at the island's dairy industry. Everything from farming operations to shipping to the cows themselves have been damaged. Lizzie visited the coastal town of Atillo, where dairy farmers took a huge hit.
Atillo is in, frankly, fairly rough shape. You know, when you get into the area, there are power lines down in lots of places, debris on the sides of the streets. And we went to one dairy farm called Vacaria Ceiba del Mar. And actually, I should say, it is one dairy farm that is now kind of the post-Hurricane Maria result of the merging of three dairy farms from the same owner, because so many cows died during the storm and they had to do so much to sort of consolidate the farms that now they've just got one.
So this is post-storm consolidation in the local industry, mm-hmm. just because the smaller farms couldn't keep up. They had too many deaths.
They had too many deaths, and frankly, there wasn't power when we were there. They had to essentially walk cattle through the streets of Atillo to get them to this one central property. They had some 200 cows die. There were some cows sort of separate from the rest of the herd when we were there because they were sick. There was another spot down kind of beyond the barn where they had actually burned the bodies of these cows. And, you know, I should say, it was actually challenging to communicate with these guys before we got there because there was no phone there, there was no electricity, and they are running every day on diesel. I want to play you some sound from Luis Martinez, who's the manager of the farm. You know, diesel generators are meant to be run one day, 2 days a week, not several months. Here's Luis.
Y de verdad que es algo también bien costoso.
And it's very expensive. We've spent over $20,000 in diesel. It's been frustrating. That generator uses almost 100 gallons of diesel a day.
$20,000 in diesel, yeah. Lizzie, is an amount of cost that just over and above everything else that an already consolidated operation has to worry about.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the cost of losing one cow is about $2,500, $2,600. So this operation lost a lot of money, and they're sort of trying to get things back on their feet now.
So that's a little bit how Luis Martinez is getting by, and we're going to hear more from him. Lizzie, how are the cows getting by?
You know, this is one of the things that he and I actually talked about. Apart from the deaths that they, you know, had at this farm during the storm and after the storm, cows actually can be very sensitive animals. When a big trauma happens, they fall off in milk. They stop milk production. So not only did the farm have to get rid of some good milk because there was no distribution system to get it to its customers after the storm, but they sort of had to work to get the cows back up to their, you know, sort of pre-storm production levels. And that was a challenge. I asked Luis Martinez, you know, did the cows fall off in milk?
Sí, bajaron. Por eso digo que la producción bajó.
Yes, it dropped. Their production dropped. And some that were brought over weren't used to this farm. So those wouldn't produce as usual. To this day, they still don't. We're producing about 4,000 liters less than we were before, all three farms combined.
Lizzie, that's the stress on the cows themselves. That's the stress on the local economy. Tell me about the neighborhood a little bit more. How far behind, let's say, San Juan or other more populated areas is Atillo lagging in terms of recovery?
Oh, I think fairly significantly. I mean, power is really kind of the central thing that is the backbone of this recovery. But there's also so much destruction. I mean, we spent time with a woman who lives in Atillo, works at a big Walmart in Atillo. Walmart is a very large employer there. It was destroyed. She had only had a couple of days of work since the storm and really only short shifts. So the whole area was really pummeled. And then in terms of the dairy industry, you know, they were having a hard time getting their product out and getting it to the island distributors and the supermarkets there, in part because a lot of those supermarkets don't have power to do things like keep milk cold.
So, Lizzie, the federal government has stepped in here. There's been some grant money pumping into the island for the dairy industry. Is it working? Is it enough?
Well, certainly at Vacaria Sable del Mar, they had feed and they had worked with the U.S. government. So there's about $12 million from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to feed cattle for a month. And the idea is sort of to do this emergency food program so that people can then get their supply chains back up and running and get the kind of feed and inputs they need for their farms to be successful. It's unclear whether they're going to continue anything like that as we sort of think about this in the larger universe of aid for the island.
So, Lizzie, we're talking about milk. We're talking about cheese. These are the very basics, right? What does this story say to you about the state of Puerto Rico in recovery now?
Well, I think there are two things it says. Number one, you're talking about sort of industries on the island and their need to keep going. But then these are consumer-facing industries. And both the producers and the consumers are really reliant on one thing, and that is power. And it's hard to overstate how necessary reliable power is for recovery. We spent time with the colonel who's the head of the Army Corps of Engineers power project, and you know they are trying to get power back on. But when you see those numbers, Todd, that say 70% of power generation is restored, it is really important to keep in your mind that's power generation. That doesn't mean 70% of people on the island have power, because different places use power in different ways. And so if your corner grocery store doesn't have power, if it's not getting that milk and cheese, that is a crucial link in deciding whether you stay or not and whether that dairy farmer or that corner store owner makes a living.
A visit to the dairy industry in northern Puerto Rico is a sign of the state of recovery and maybe things to come as the island recovers from Hurricane Maria. Lizzie O'Leary, host of Marketplace Weekend. Lizzie, it's a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Be sure to check out Lizzie's reporting on Puerto Rico as part of her hour-long special, The Economics of Disaster. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up, we head out west, where the scale of the destruction this fire season has left thousands of Californians without their homes or their possessions.
There is a very high likelihood that they will be significantly below a 50% reoccupation rate at the two-year anniversary.
And we've been asking you if you've ever lost your home to a natural disaster.
Hi, this is Ostea from Andersonville. My single mother and I lived near a creek that had been flooding over for a couple of weeks, and it would cause everyone's basements to flood, and for us, that would be our home. And I tried to grab as many of the family books as I could. In the midst of all of that, my mother was so distraught and kind of lost that all she could grab was a little diamond-encrusted cross that I had given her on my graduation. That's all she was able to get.
The practicalities of putting life back together after a natural disaster, that's coming up here on The Takeaway. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick, and we go now to California for more of our coverage today on how Americans are coping and recovering from natural disasters. It's been one of the worst fire seasons in California history. Residents in Southern California face an existential threat from the effects of the late-season Thomas Fire in the mountains of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Meanwhile, back in October, California's wine country further north was scorched by fires, causing the destruction of an estimated 9,000 structures. These fires have meant staggering losses for residents, people who've lost their homes, in some cases, nearly all of their belongings. Ken Klein is a law professor at California Western School of Law and a legal expert on natural disasters. Ken explains what steps people need to take when they get down to the business of recovery.
Think about the things you have to do as you're going through the steps of trying to rebuild. The first thing you have to do is find a place to live. Then you start the process of just having stuff to live with. For example, I lost my home in the 2003 fires, and the first thing I bought the next day was a toothbrush because I didn't own one. So you have to acquire things to just bridge your life until you rebuild. Then you'll go through the entire process of making a buildable pad, potentially drawing plans, going through plan check, hiring contractors, all of that work. One of the coverages you have in your home insurance policy are all the expenses you're incurring to live elsewhere because you still owe your mortgage payment on top of now whatever rent you're going to pay if you can find a place to live. And all those expenses, such as that rent, are called alternative living expenses, or ALE. Most, not all, but most home insurance policies have a one-year time limit in which to spend that ALE, and you simply cannot rebuild, in all likelihood, within a year. So California law states that if the state declares an emergency, which all of these fires have been declared, that the period of time in which you're entitled to ALE cannot be less than 2 years.
So that means that people have a two-year limit to still collect these benefits while they rebuild. Look, as you said, there are going to be thousands, tens of thousands of homes that need to be rebuilt, and people are going to have to wait in line for construction, for contractors, for professionals to get in there. Is 2 years going to work for a lot of people?
2 years is not going to work for a lot of people. For example, in the fire we had here in San Diego in 2003, my neighborhood lost 312 homes. That's 312 homes out of 12,000 homes. And 62% of us were rebuilt at the two-year anniversary. The problems, delays, challenges in Ventura and in Santa Rosa and in the county of Sonoma are enormously larger. I think there is a very high likelihood that they will be significantly below a 50% reoccupation rate at the two-year anniversary.
So, Ken, you talk about your own experience in 2003. You lost your home in the Cedar Fire near San Diego. Were you an expert in this type of law and in what it takes to rebuild in California before it became a reality for you?
Absolutely not. I was a working lawyer in a national law firm. And I thought I was a pretty smart guy who knew a good bit about insurance and law. And when my home burned down, I learned that I knew absolutely nothing. And over the course of the next year, I say I became an involuntary expert in all sorts of things. But I knew absolutely nothing when my home burned down.
And so you've been through this horrible experience yourself. What do people need to know out of the gate here? I mean, you've talked about the two-year limit. It's not going to be enough. That might be a policy issue in Sacramento. What about individuals? What do they need to be thinking about in these first few weeks of trying to rebuild their lives?
They're going to have to learn all sorts of things at both a legal level, at a logistical level, at a system level, at an emotional level. They're going to have to become very careful record keepers. They're going to have to keep bins of receipts of their alternative living expenses. They need to keep journals or diaries of everyone they speak to and what was said. They're going to have to navigate a lot of conversations with people that are much more knowledgeable than they are and have legal implications, such as insurance adjusters and their bank or mortgage company. And then they're going to have this whole emotional landscape they're going to have to navigate. For example, not let the fire define who they are, but just understand that it's a bad thing that happened in their life. And then they're going to have to learn something that doesn't come naturally to them, which is to accept help. Many of us, most of us perhaps, are raised to be self-sufficient, to be people who give help and not accept help. And they're going to have to get past that and learn that at least for the period of time that they are surrounded by folks who genuinely want to offer them help and ask, is there anything I can do, to always say yes.
Was that a hard lesson for you to learn?
It was a brutally hard lesson for me to learn. And in fact, ultimately, I would have not learned it had my wife not been convincing to me that this was how we were going to get back and get back to our lives as they were before the fire, at least as close as we could get to that.
So that was in 2003, the fire that you and your family survived. It's 2017 now. How long did it take before you looked around and looked at your kitchen or your house or stood on the front lawn and thought, yeah, we're back to normal?
When I no longer think about the fire and no longer reach for something in a drawer, for instance, in a holiday season decoration that I only use annually, I don't realize that it was something that I had before the fire and no longer own. When I get to the point where I'm there, I'll let you know. It's been 14 years, not there yet.
Wow, and that just paints a picture, Ken, for what so many thousands of people in California are about to be going through. It must give you a lot to think about, having been through this yourself, knowing that so many people, through no choice of their own, are about to join a club that you're already part of.
I genuinely feel for these folks. As I meet them, they're walking in, they're dazed, they're disoriented, and I really see myself looking in a mirror. And what I tell them oftentimes is, you get always at least two fires. You get your fire and the next one. Because if we get this exactly right, you'll be doing what I'm doing for the next group of people impacted by a fire.
Ken Klein, law professor at California Western School of Law. Ken, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all for us today. We've been looking through the lens of natural disasters and recovery, and for Americans, it's been a tough year. Storms and storm surges and fires hit, and when the weather reports are done, you're left with the suffering faces of our fellow humans, and with the reality of destroyed homes and displaced lives and stretched institutions. These disasters are also a mirror. How well did we do in making our communities whole, in funding their rebuilding, and in taking seriously the fact that these events are getting more frequent and more severe and will likely be worse in the future? A hurricane or a fire wipe things away and give people a chance to rebuild. They also give us the responsibility to look at ourselves and make sure we're doing all we can to prepare and protect our American family. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.